Greetings, kindred witches. Welcome to this episode of Atomic Witchcraft.
Here, we share our experiences as we build a modern-day inclusive witchcraft practice rooted in nature seasons, celestial cycles, and the science of energy.
Join us as we build a craft that learns from our past, is rooted in our present, and works toward building a better future, all while connecting deeply to the earth and sky around us.
Let us begin a new era of witchcraft. Hi everyone, I'm Ash, an atomic witch walking an eclectic road since the 90s.
I'm Alyssa, about 20 years in and growing a mostly green path.
And I'm Jay, new to the practice, composing a bard witch's craft. Because witch weaves together many webs, past, present, and future, we'd like to acknowledge that we are currently practicing our craft on the lands of the Coast Salish peoples, specifically the Duwamish, Muckleshoot, and Puyallup tribes.
The Atomic team participates in Real Rent, and we encourage you to engage with and contribute to similar programs in your area.
Welcome to our grove, here at the Atomic Hearth. Now, let's get witchy. Welcome back to the Atomic Hearth. As we approach the new moon this cycle, I'm sharing my journey reigniting the fire within. This is my second topic of the year, and one in which I am approaching from a deeper level, incorporating not only the mundane and natural aspects of elemental work, but the psychological and shadow representations as well. As always, we will be featuring our usual segments as well, including Charting the Celestial, where we'll chat about some upcoming celestial events with Mercury, a lunar eclipse for our Europe witches, and the Coalsack Nebula. Then the story of Cygnus, and finally some magic in the molecules. In our quarterly subject, which will be book club this time, we share our mutual reading of The Magic of Physics by Felix Flicker, uncovering the fantastical phenomena of everyday life. And finally, Resistance Radio, to bring you methods mundane and magical to connect your craft into community and activism. This month, we will be tending the fire of building resilience as we continue the fight. So, let's lift off into the cosmos with our first section, Charting the Celestial.
Eyes on the sky. What's in the sky for this coming new moon to new moon cycle? If you missed the chance to spot Mercury in the evening sky last month, you'll get another shot on August 19th. But this time, Mercury can be spotted in the morning, just before sunrise. A lot of my same advice from episode 144 applies here as well. You'll want totally clear skies with a good line of sight to the horizon, no trees or buildings in the way at all. Because Mercury is so close to the sun, it only ever appears close to the horizon, before either setting with the sun, or just before it rises and we lose sight of it in the bright morning light. To see this planet on August 19th, you'll want to head outside pretty early in the morning, probably around 4 or 5 a.m., depending on what time the sunrise is in your area. Go ahead and face east, either by using navigational stars, a compass, or an astronomy app. Look close to the horizon for what appears to be a small, dim star. And there's Mercury. Of course, any stargazing tools you have will come in handy here, since it's a little tricky to spot with visual cues alone. While Mercury can be seen this month from both hemispheres, the southern will actually get a bit of a better view. The night of September 7th will host a full lunar eclipse. This celestial event occurs during a full moon, when the Earth comes between it and the sun, causing a shadow to be cast on the moon. When the eclipse hits totality, the moon often glows with a rusty reddish hue known as the blood moon. It is caused by the sunlight striking the Earth's atmosphere and refracting red light waves, which are then reflected on the moon. Like the solar eclipse we talked about in episode 138, lunar eclipses come with many beliefs from different cultures and mythologies that span human history. Anything from demons causing the moon to hide and thus it's a time of chaos and danger, or that it is a powerful time for introspection and should therefore be set in meditation. If you do choose to use the energy of the eclipse in your witchcraft, just be mindful of any closed practices and beliefs around the celestial event. The September 7th lunar eclipse can be seen from Asia, Africa, Australia, Antarctica, and Europe. So almost everyone can see at least part of it, except for those of us in the Americas. The very start of the show begins at 1528 UTC, and will hit totality at 1730 UTC. With totality lasting 83 minutes, so plenty of time to catch a glimpse. As with any stargazing or celestial event, you'll want no clouds or other obstructions blocking the view, and the less lights you can have, the better, though I have successfully witnessed lunar eclipses with urban lights around in the past. During the summer months in the Northern Hemisphere, Cygnus, aka the Swan, flies high in the eastern sky in the evening. The main shape of this constellation is made up of 10 stars, 4 which make up the long line that is the body and neck of the Swan, and 6 that make up its wings. It does look like a stick figure swan, or a lowercase t, and this simple shape helps make it easier to spot than some of the other constellations we've explored so far. The tail, which lies at the top of the lowercase t shape, is marked with the star Deneb, which is the brightest in the constellation. From there, you can follow out to the arms of the t that make the wings, and follow the line of stars to the swan's head, marked by the star Albireo. Albireo is actually a binary, or double star, made up of a larger yellow star and a smaller blue one. To see our celestial swan, head outside on a clear night around 9 or 10 p.m. and face east using one of the methods we've discussed here before. You'll want to look pretty high up into the sky, not directly overhead, but definitely in the upper third of the celestial dome. Because of this high point, you don't need to worry about having a totally clear horizon view. Some low buildings and trees are okay here. The easiest point to start with is its brightest star, Deneb, and then you can follow the shape of the swan from there. On a dark and clear enough night, you may even see the galactic haze of the Milky Way that Cygnus flies over. If you have a telescope, be sure to get it out and point it towards the swan's head, Albireo. Even with a small telescope, you should be able to see the distinct yellow and blue stars, rather than just one point of light. Last episode, I talked about the Jewel Box Cluster in the Southern Hemisphere, a brilliant collection of stars that looks like a bright patch in the night sky. Today, however, is about a celestial body that is almost the exact opposite, at least visually, the Coalsack Nebula. The Coalsack is a dark nebula, which is an interstellar cloud of cosmic dust that's so dense it absorbs and scatters and blocks visible light. This gives the appearance of an inky black spot where it looks like there should be stars. The Coalsack is also so large that it is visible to the naked eye. To see this one the best, you're going to want very dark skies. No moonlight, no street lights, nothing if you can help it. Of course, you will also want it to be very clear, so no smog, mist, or clouds. We are once again using our old friend Crux as the guiding point. In fact, the nebula resides just outside of this constellation. In fact, it lies just below the Jewel Box. So in these perfect conditions, head out and face south and locate the Jewel Box using the steps from episode 146. Turning your gaze just below that, there will be what looks like a black cloud. That is our nebula. I did try to use my astronomy app to find this one, but was unsuccessful. I do have a free version, so I don't think I had access to that information for bodies like this. So keep that in mind if you decide to use an app to find this night sky object. If you look at the Coalsack, though, through a pair of binoculars, you'll actually see a couple of stars in front of it. These are not points of light coming through, but rather those stars are closer to us than the nebula is. When we think of objects of interest in the night sky, we imagine brilliant lights from stars, planets, and the moon, swirling clouds of luminous dust, the soft glow of the Milky Way. But these patches of darkness, like the Coalsack, remind us as witches that you can't have the one without the other, the light without the dark. It's the swirling cosmic dance that showcases how important balance is, and to not ignore the beauty that comes with both the stars and the dust from which they are born.
If the skies were actually the grandest gala ball ever held, then the swirling cosmic dance above would be shared by a seemingly bottomless guest list of dancers. Today, our eyes focus on Cygnus, the Swan, a character mixed of both timeless beauty and heartfelt sorrow. But why was this swan so sad? Who were they, and what can we learn from their story? Let's dive in and hear the song of this starry swan. In the mythos of the Greeks, Cygnus has offered the identity of numerous swans of legend and tale. In one story, it was the swan disguise used by Zeus when seducing Leda of Sparta, who would give birth to such famous children as Helen of Troy and the Gemini twins Castor and Pollux. Yet another version tells us this swan was a final form of the lover and musician Orpheus, a post-death form, fitting in sorrow, as he died still deep in grief over the loss of his love Eurydice. Today, though, our story shall not come from Greece, but Rome, where this celestial swan was known to be Cygnus of Liguria, a man of such deep love and devotion that he earned his place among the stars. Cygnus was the son of Liguria's king, Sthenelus. His profession, a musician, a singer, in fact. It was said that Cygnus was blessed by Apollo himself with this talent, and even as he surpassed his father and became the new king, he still continued to sing and earn renown far and wide for his musical skill. That said, it was not fame and artistic hopes that drove Cygnus's passions, but instead a deep love he held for the foolhardy son of Helios, Phaethon, whose name means the radiant. Cygnus would watch him from afar, admiring how his confidence shined unlike any other. "What if he does not see the same shine in me?" Cygnus wondered, and worried, and sang to him, but just from out of earshot. Phaethon, on the contrary, did indeed long for fame, through recognition as Helios' son, and so one day chose to travel far to the east to meet his father where he rose, to assure his parentage. Once arrived, Phaethon was amazed to see Helios' son's chariot in person, and asked to drive it across the sky for a day. At first, Helios refused right out. "I want to shine like you, father. I will drive your chariot with skill. Do not worry." "This is foolish. You have no experience in doing so, and to cross the sky in my chariot is no simple feat. It takes judgment and focus." Phaethon heeded no warning uttered here, and asked, and asked, and soon Helios was at wit's end. He reluctantly bestowed Phaethon the reins, hoping to all creation that this relentless son of his might actually be up to the task. Without hesitation, Phaethon charged away, and all the world, including our Cygnus, would bear witness to the inevitable. With a force unprecedented, Helios' horses charged forth as they did every morning. Only this time, their driver lacked the might and skill required to control them. The blazing chariot swerved far from Earth, leaving the world suddenly cold and dark. Then back too far, scorching the ground and boiling the sea. Zeus could only permit this kind of charade for so long. And with a crack and a rumble to follow, Phaethon's first ride became his last, and he fell to the world below, struck down by divine lightning. His body fell to the river Eridanus, where Cygnus rushed in desperate pursuit to know of the fate of the foolhardy man he so loved. The river reached, and his love's death now certain, Cygnus sat by the water and began to mourn. He retrieved Phaethon's bones from the water to give them a proper burial. He remembered and he sang, and he remained so long there in mourning that he drew the attention of many a god and goddess. He didn't care that Phaethon was a fool in his ambitions. He didn't care that his love was still one-sided. His love was, and would be, unconditional and unyielding. Even after he returned to his home in Liguria, he lamented daily until he grew old and gray. And so upon his death, the gods brought him into the sky as a beautiful swan singing one last song, a swan song, a final message to his beloved. It would be heard among the heavens forever, for this love that was still unrequited and yet forever true. As you gaze upon the cosmic dance above, swirling amidst the dust and gleam, let Cygnus the Swan provide the reminder that while some dance in joy, some too sway in sorrow, and in their song bring balance to the stars above. And so these stories are told, drawn from the crisscrossing arcs and swirls above our magical minds. The cosmic cornucopia calls us to lie back, look up, and let our minds wander and wonder. As cultures around the world map their skies in a wonderful diversity of stories and interpretations, we encourage you to learn about the stories in your culture and of the ancestors of the land on which you reside.
Mercury, the planet that wreaks havoc when it's in retrograde, or apparent retrograde. 3 to 4 times a year, we experience the phenomena of a neighboring planet appearing to reverse its course, moving backward across the sky. You may notice that while planets appear as twinkling stars on the skyline, they actually move in relation to the stars around them, which instead creates a constant rotating backdrop, always in the same relation to each other. This apparent retrograde illusion happens due to the difference in the size and paths of our orbit around the Sun relative to Mercury. Because of this, it is said that when Mercury is in retrograde, communication, finances, and travel goes awry, a standard set by the Roman god Mercury, who ruled over such things. When Mercury is moving as it should, things are said to flow smoothly, even magnetically. Mercury and the Magnetic Fields sounds like a cool band name, but it's also rooted in some interesting facts. According to NASA, moving at a lightning pace of 88 Earth days in a year, Mercury's orbit around the Sun is both extremely hot and extremely cold. Its proximity to the Sun means temperatures reach 800 degrees Fahrenheit, but its lack of atmosphere means that nightly temperatures drop to nearly negative 290 degrees Fahrenheit. Brr. Venus still holds the record as the hottest planet due to its atmosphere, but Mercury has its own unique secret, its magnetic field, or rather, lack thereof. Being so close to the Sun, and with a weak atmosphere housing only 1% of the magnetic field of the Earth's, Mercury is at the whims of the magnetic solar winds, which send magnetic tornadoes spiraling down to the surface of this planet. NASA states that when the ions strike the surface, they knock off neutrally charged atoms and send them on a loop high into the sky. This provides a cosmic example of the interactions of magnetic fields, a phenomenon that continues here on Earth, and within us, as humans. Here on Earth, our planetary magnetic field creates a bit of an energetic shield, one that protects us from solar flares and winds, making us a bit of a unique planet among our neighbors. It shields our atmosphere from erosion that occurs during instances of coronal mass ejections or cosmic rays. This strong and dense magnetosphere is what allows our atmosphere to thrive. According to NASA, nearly all of Earth's geomagnetic field originates in the fluid of the outer core. Like boiling water on a stove, convection forces, which move heat from one place to another, usually through air or water, constantly churn the molten metals at the core of our planet, which also swirl in whirlpools driven by the Earth's rotation. As this roiling, boiling mass of metal moves around, it generates electrical currents hundreds of miles wide and flowing at thousands of miles per hour as Earth rotates. Now, this mechanism, which is responsible for maintaining Earth's magnetic field, is known as geodynamo. And what is even more magical is that as the Earth generates its own magnetic field, creatures on the planet are tuning in, using it to navigate. Caltech has confirmed, quote, that humans' neurophysiology is indeed sensitive to magnetism. We have discovered specific rotations of Earth-strength fields that trigger distinctive brainwave activity that shows that we are subconsciously processing geomagnetic stimuli. This means that we, too, are impacted by the geomagnetics around us. Now, they go on to say, quote, here on Earth, we live surrounded by an ever-present geomagnetic field that varies in intensity and direction across the planetary surface. Many species, from bacteria to algae to animals, can sense this field and use geomagnetic stimuli to navigate and survive. Some birds migrate over thousands of miles using the field to keep track of where they are and where they're going. Other birds, mammals, reptiles, and fish home to specific locations through geomagnetic cues. A magnetic sense allows burrowing mole rats to navigate underground mazes in total darkness. End quote. This amazing sense is the nature and the planet communicating, subtly, through the interaction of magnetics. But okay, this is where it gets really interesting. Stay with me here. The research website goes on to say billions of years ago, magnetotactic bacteria evolved the ability to precipitate crystals of the iron-based mineral magnetite in their single cells. Lining up the chains, magnetite crystals form the physical basis for magnetoreception, acting as compasses to align the bacteria's swimming direction along those local magnetic field lines of the Earth, allowing the bacteria to move along a straight line rather than kind of tumbling chaotically as they seek out nutrients and grow and multiply. Magnetite has been found in many animals, ranging from the teeth of mollusks to specialized cells in the snout of rainbow trout. In humans, magnetite crystals are widely distributed across many areas of the brain. End quote. Now, I recommend reading the entire Caltech website and or paper. It is fascinating. But the fact that we are able to use geomagnetics, that we have a sense that allows us to navigate using Earth's magnetic field. Now, this is not the same as EMFs or electromagnetic fields. Caltech does a great job in summarizing here. In our experiment, Alpha ERD shows that the human brain can detect Earth-strength magnetic fields, demonstrating that we have a sensory system that processes the geomagnetic field all around us. Potentially, we and our nomadic hunter-gatherer ancestors could use a magnetic sense to navigate and survive. Now, as for EMFs, our current science says that we as humans emit small amounts of electromagnetic fields, and they come from the electrical synapses in our brains and the firing of our heart. Our brain's electric magnetic fields, or EMFs, are so hard to capture that they must be measured through a very sensitive MEG machine. However, our heart seems to give off a bigger pulse as all synapses fire together. Now, I use the word bigger in quotes because magnetism comes from the flow of electrons, electrical or liquid, much like the motion at the core of our planet. Now, we've all felt our heart pushing our blood flow, but let's be clear, that pump is in direct proportion to the amount of electromagnetic field it can emit, which means it's only going to be ever so strong, so loud, so distant, because it's only so big. But it does speak as to why hugging someone, you can feel their heartbeat for 30 seconds and it will calibrate your internal systems into alignment, like magnets coming into parallel form. This to be said, we do have direct impact over that magnetic field, both through how our brain fires and how our heart beats. Think about how this ties into our core practices of mindfulness and self-awareness and the impact it may have on your craft. Now, as for the impact of electromagnetic radiation, look, it's out there, and we know that too many high-caliber electrical wires, cell phone towers, and even cell phones themselves are creating areas of harm. That being said, just like anything, they are tools. Use them safely and consider your own personal sensitivity. Most electronics shed very negligible impact that doesn't even penetrate our skin, but close-range electronics that emit an EMF due to the circulating of energy are a different situation. I don't want to be in tinfoil hat conspiracy corner over here, but I think it's important to say, you know, be tuned in to science as it comes out. I love technology, but our wireless, in-the-pocket, on-the-go technology means we're always kind of tapped in, whether psychologically or on a more subtle electromagnetic level. Now, magnetic fields are truly the essence of magic in the molecules. Seen in scale from the cosmic to the quantum, they are the root of which so much holds our universe together. A science unto their own. I encourage you to listen more deeply, not just with your minds and hearts, but with the magnetism within. Fire. It's a topic that sits squarely with the other elements as the second layer of our witch's wheel. From an atomic perspective, the elements represent the four states of matter: solid, liquid, gas, and plasma. They are not only tangible in the manifestations, but provide us lenses with which to view not only the world, but our crafts and our internal selves as well. For many witches, our introduction to the elements often starts in a more tactile incorporation, a stone or a candle on the altar, a bowl of water, our breath. Then it might move outward to mountains, volcanoes, oceans, and weather. From an atomic perspective, the elements represent the four states of matter: solid, liquid, gas, and plasma. From macro to micro, from celestial to quantum, as without, so within. And that brings us back to how we might look at the representation and existence of the elements within ourselves. Earth and bone, air and breath, fire and blood, water and flesh. But again, from a philosophical or spiritual perspective, the concept of balancing the elements within our bodies is something ancient, predating Empedocles and Socrates to Zoroastrian religion. Now, in modern times, I'm a big believer in the use of witchcraft as a psychological tool, one that helps achieve and live in alignment with my values. Because I apply my craft through an elemental and atomic perspective or lens, I'm often looking at how the two philosophies can help deepen my self-alignment, build internal relationships, and, you know, just understand myself better. All those, you know, kind of help impact how I show up in the world. You know, for me, being witch isn't just the craft itself, it's also just like how I live. So with the elements, they each provide examples of ways our internal worlds might manifest. Astrology actually leads really heavy into this with the use of the astrological signs and elemental correspondence, you know, fire signs, water signs. This is the elemental lens at work. Our associations with the elements are all going to be slightly different. We've had that conversation even with the seasons, but there are some commonalities that we tend to see. You know, earth asks us to be grounded, resilient, and strong, and yet nurturing. Air offers us a view on expansion, the energy of peace and wisdom, the power of potential. Fire is passionate, the energy of anger and love, a lesson in duality. While water flows, teaching us about change and release as it shapes its course. Now, finding balance between the elements is where that shadow self comes in. It's part of ourselves that is hard to look at. It's the dark echo of who we are or want to be. It's the thoughts we can't control, the parts of ourselves we deny, the parts that are hard to face. It's the consequences of our choices and the secrets we sleep with. It is literally the shadow we cast from our own light. The elements provide tools and contexts in which I might strive to strike balance within myself. And because of that, it also often means traipsing through a field of shadow work. And that's, you know, how I find myself here, revisiting the element of fire 28 years into my practice, looking to reignite something that just feels absent. There was a time in my youth where fire was the element I connected most closely with. I was passionate, confident, angry, and I felt like I could burn the world down. But there was also hope and romance. There was connection and movement. Most of my life, I've been a casual dancer, a way to exist solely in the cells of my body. I also grew up mostly in areas of sunshine, sometimes relentless sunshine. And now here I am nearing 40 and my life just feels kind of buggy. Saturated ground, you know, like soggy sadness wrapped in the weight of the world. The stubbornness of earth with the emotions of water, you know, creating a bit of an internal bog. Now, where did that fire go? How do I get that spark back? And yes, I know I live in the Pacific Northwest. This is just the climate. And while that may be the case, perhaps it's even more important to find my inner fire again. As someone, you know, who has physical limitations, many of my old ways of existing in that fire realm just like aren't options anymore, at least not in the same form. And I honestly haven't yet discovered those new ways to engage, which is what led me here to the point of return.
Return of the flame.
I knew when I selected the fire element, I was going to have to do some shadow work, and I knew it would be deep. I'm also not going to make this an episode about that shadow work, but to give it some context, anger issues have always been prevalent in the women in my family. Hell hath no worry like my grandmother scorned. Then in my early 20s, while I was working in news at a television station, I watched in horror as the first of what would become many fires spread through our community. I had nightmares after that, and over time, the constant stress around fire is actually part of what pushed me north here to Seattle. You know, a place I had dreamed of living since I was a kid, but about a month after I arrived, my home community was hit with terrible fires again, and 6 months later, the mudslides hit. We lost pets, people, places. The elements fighting out a game of balance. It was horrifying to watch from a distance, kind of etching this ravine of sadness that just seems to be getting bigger with all that's been happening in life and the world, you know, yeah. One thing and then another.
That's real.
So it's time to dry things out and find that fire again. Enter episode number 58, Fire, from Stage Left. My own words could serve as wisdom, right?
Of course.
Right?
Sure.
Nothing sparked.
Aww.
I tried a full moon meditation and literally a small puff of smoke when I tried to bring fire to life on the astral. And then a vision of being consumed by flames.
That's just rude.
Yeah. Lovely, right? And, you know, maybe not the omen I'm hoping for. You know, appreciate you stepping up to the plate there, subconscious shadow. But clearly some mental health work and stuff needed to be done there in the shadow realm. Now, I knew it was going to be a bumpy ride. And when the going gets rough, it's time to call in reinforcements. So I began to ask, where and how does the fire element show up in our lives? And then through that, how can my witchcraft practice support that need to ignite or dry things out and be lit up again without just going up in flames entirely? Clearly, my own words weren't enough. It was time to instead turn to my Grove community. So, Alyssa J., I asked you before, but if you will share with us now, how does Shire...
The Shire. I want to live in the Shire.
Yeah, me too.
How does the Shire show up in your lives?
Well, lots of ways. Anyway, So, Alyssa J., I asked you before, but if you'll share with us now, how does fire show up for you in your lives, your practices? How do you both keep it alight and in check?
Yeah, speaking for me personally, fire is like my number two element after earth. And I totally acknowledge that like people go through changes and sort of these periods in their life when they're trying on different elements, or maybe like one season of their life it's water, one season it's fire. For me, it's pretty much been this constant dance between earth and fire. Sometimes one will emerge over the other, but it's usually these two at the top. I do tend to run hot, energetically speaking, and because of this, I do need to balance with that water element. In the past, we've talked a lot about ways to connect with the element, whether that's solar, electrical, metaphorical fire, and the way that I practice with it most is in that flame form, that like good old spark. And that said, I do use it in my practice very often. Anytime I'm doing spell work, meditating, or just tapping into my craft, I light a candle or two. Even if fire is not the main focus, it's always present. When it is the main focus, I most often work with it when I need some oomph put into energy, you know, for example, like banishing work, or I'm looking to spark the fires of creativity. It also so easily ties into other focuses for me, like the whole journey I had with smoke magic recently. I needed fire to be a part of that to generate the smoke. It also ties into my kitchen crafts with hot stoves, hot ovens, tending those flames to produce my desired outcomes. I also go beyond the candle on the altar to campfires. I'm quite good at tending a fire and kind of intuiting what it needs. It's something I've pretty much always had a skill in. I grew up with a lot of wilderness skills, like learning those as a kid. So developing this ability to conjure fire from very little was something that was instilled in me in a young age. So there's this dance that you've got to learn of how to keep it lit without risking it getting out of control. It just comes with practice. And then outside of my witchcraft practice and connecting it in that way, my fire shows up in my creative endeavors, specifically acting, specifically Shakespeare. There is just something about those words that just hits me in a fiery core, and that tends to be the place I perform from. I also tend to lean into fiery music when I need some like get up and go energy, and this can be indie rock like Florence and the Machine or dramatic theatrical folk music like The Amazing Devil.
Well, I have to admit, I actually had mostly switched to battery candles, which is great and fine, but that absence of actual flame is part of ritual. Well, you know, you're right. If I wanted to bring fire back to my life, maybe that's probably a good place to start, you know, get back to the heart of things a bit.
I love the battery candles. They're super convenient, but yeah, sometimes you need that.
That fire. Real spark, little spire. And I love that tip about controlling it kind of coming from practice. It's definitely something I'm going to have to work on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it will be an endeavor. And of course, the music tip, which will come up a bit later. You know, unexpectedly, my own process has also been filled with a lot of smoke, you know, based on your previous topic, which tends to happen when you try to burn wet things.
Yes.
For me, that smoke has really acted as a bit of a clog in the system, you know, kind of creating anxious thoughts that smoke a lot, but don't really ever ignite into anything useful. And just like the spinning wheels and expensive energy.
Yeah, you gotta let the stuff dry out before you ignite it.
Well, yeah, but how do you dry it? You gotta dry it out somehow, right? Like, where does that come from? So Jay, what about you? How does fire show up for you energetically and in your practice?
Yeah, I'm going to start where Alyssa left off. Fire shows up for me very much, I'd say primarily as my number one thing in creative things like music and storytelling, and as of recently in visually creative fields like sigil magic. You know, this is the fire of inspiration and creativity. It's an internal creation power that I'm feeling when a story I'm writing starts to like take on a life of its own, or a musical performance that becomes way more than just the right notes and rhythms, really roots into the fire of the soul. I can feel those moments in various performances, and it really does feel like there is a swirling energetic spark that is carrying the performance forward. And it's not that I'm not in control of it anymore, but I am no longer the engine. It is the engine, and I am just the vessel being driven. Fire also roots into my interconnected web kind of work, in like business witch workings, which like often does contextualize a lot of my spell work into my work life, where the fire of interpersonal connections and networks contextualizes the workings that I focus on. Hearth magic, is a fire focus for me. I lean into the warmth of cultivating atmosphere, energy that's inviting. And then I've talked about this sometimes in past episodes. I love fire in the world of kinetic activities and thinking of it from a kinetic energy standpoint.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of years practicing athletics in the fields of strength training, martial arts and fighting sports, using dance energy for my energy raising. Like, movement is really big, and I know you said that's not everybody has the same ability to apply fire in those realms, but you know, to me those have been big ones for me. Yeah. So if that is something that you like to do, it's a great place for to anybody out there. That's a great place you might find some fire, or you know, channel your inner fire. But at the end of the day, fire is important. Fire is like my number two element with air, because it is the element of transformation for me. It leaves things changed from their prior state, often in ways that are, they fully leaves the old state behind. But you know, at the same time, relating to some of these things I've mentioned, I see fire as a provider, a power behind comfort, warmth, and combining ingredients together to turn them into something those individual parts could not be on their own. So maybe these are some other ways you can try drying out. For me, fire and air are really those number two. I do find that they play really well together. Air can be an interesting entry into more firework for me sometimes. I'm trying to figure out my split, but I feel like I'm probably 60-40 air to fire now in my overall practice.
Yeah, you make a great point about fire being dependent on air. And it was actually as I started to really rotate this element and trying to approach it from all sides, that as I approached it from more of a science, a fire science aspect, it was clear that I was missing some key elements to just like practical fire making,
yeah.
Even like on the more like psychological level, right? Like fire requires three things: fuel, an oxidizing agent, which is usually air, and heat. And then these trigger the fourth state of the fire, which is of the fire tetrahedron, which is the chemical reaction or burning. So of course, air as an oxidizing agent is key to fire, but so is the fuel, and often this is carbon based. So now earth and air have stepped into the fray, you know, so much for this just being about fire. And it really is, I guess, instead it's about getting the right balance. Mm-hmm. And internally for me, this means that not only do I need fuel, which might be literal fuel for my body like food, or metaphorical like reasoning or values, but I also need air and heat. So for example, the current actions of the government become my fuel, my words provide the breath, and my anger the heat. With just the right balance, they might ignite into righteous rage. On the other hand, the fuel might be the actions of a loved one, or the air from the words they whisper, and the heat from our exchanges. And so our love ignites, and that process stays the same, right? Fire asks us to hold two truths. We can do two different kinds of things with the same process. You know, so here I am in my first lunar cycle. I have some community input, and I'm trying on different approaches. Science, candles, the sun, movement, music, even the idea of connections between people. These are great. And those suggestions continue to bring me back to our framework to continue to really explore my angle of approach here. Solar, the suns and stars, the celestial path. What about energy, electricity, the atomic pathway? What about passion, love, and interconnection? And every time I would go to tap in, I felt locked out. I tried an astral meditation and nothing, not even a spark. Just that same loop from before. Puff of smoke, spontaneous combustion. Puff of smoke, spontaneous combustion. Let me tell you, every angle of approach, something felt blocked, stuck. And I began to ask others in my communities, you know, how do you unstick and reignite the fire? But honestly, I wasn't getting too much in the way of answers. Either folks had never been stuck, it's like one of their power elements, right? Mm-hmm. Or they didn't really know how to get unstuck either. I almost gave up, honestly, not a very fire-minded thing to do. but we thought, even as like a team, we thought about changing this episode to focus strictly on an atomic path. I thought about changing course to focus on a different topic. Rituals, something that kind of keeps tapping me on the shoulder. But something kept kind of luring me back to fire, and a beacon that kept saying, like, it all comes back to this. It all comes back to this. So one of my coping mechanisms when I get stuck is I tend to turn to comfort TV. I am a latchkey kid. It is where I find my comfort. I don't shame, you can shame me all you want, but it is where my comfort lives. And in this case, that comfort came with a good dose of animated wisdom. Lo and behold, Zuko and Aang of Avatar The Last Airbender fame, and I will tout this cartoon to the end of my days. It's so please good. Watch it.
Excellent.
And specifically The Last Airbender as a cartoon, not the movie. Watch no. the full seasons of the cartoon.
Not the Netflix one.
Even if you're not a cartoon person, just bear with me through it. You will understand as you go.
But they offered me some much needed reminders and insights. So for those not familiar, Zuko and Aang travel to the Fire Temple because their ability to bend or control fire has been blocked. And they find that in order to regain their bending, they need to learn the Dance of the Dragons. Now for Zuko and Aang, the process came through a reconnecting with the history and root of their fears around fire. Aang's inability to connect with fire was due to the fear of hurting others. You know, that kind of feels like how I feel about anger. I'm afraid. And Zuko, on the other hand, struggled because his only connection was to fire through anger. And together they learn that fire is life, the beauty and the beast of it, a kaleidoscope of colors. Aang's fear and Zuko's lesson really hit home with the shadow work I was doing. I felt those things begin to loosen and shift a bit, and their excursion to the Fire Temple and the ritual they engaged with also provided me with a little inspiration. Of course, ritual. I have been wanting to focus more on ritual building lately anyway, an endeavor that will probably be my year-long craft in 2026, but for now, reconnecting with fire through ritual already has kind of ignited a little something in me. I've been working on what I want to incorporate, from like a spicy pre-ritual meal to warm scents and the vibe of music to sigils and the feeling of a heartbeat. I've started to build a playlist asking others what ignites them, which has been a really fun and interesting conversation. And by looking at how to honor fire, it's been asking that I approach it from a variety of angles and crafts. So I'm excited to see where this takes me. With that in mind, do you all have elements that you would recommend including in a fire ritual?
Oh, I love this idea of a spicy pre-ritual meal. That sounds like such a good idea. For me personally, it would be like an Indian curry, because that's that like, oof, belly warmth.
I was definitely
warmth.
Thinking.
Oh, yeah.
But I also was thinking I want to do it at the end, too. So maybe something ooh, like a like
maybe,
more Mexican spice. And
maybe.
Then
I have an idea. You start with like the spicy meal, and then you end with like a Mexican hot chocolate with like the chilies and stuff, and the chocolate as dessert at the end of your ritual. A little treat for yourself.
Good. Yes. But I figured since fuel, food is going to be part of it, food should be part of this.
Yes, absolutely. In an ideal world for me personally, there would be a bonfire. But I acknowledge that one, it's not always practical. In fact, it's often pretty impractical. And two, it's pretty dry in the Pacific Northwest right now, so...
I would love to live in a more bonfire-ready world.
Maybe not the best of ideas in the heat of summer. But some way to actually incorporate an actual flame, whether it's like a good candle or a bunch of candles in the middle, something heat-proof to keep it safe, that kind of thing. Movement for sure, and preferably to me, movement set to drums, something with like a really heavy drum beat. That element is just so primal. I mean, like our first instruments, as far as I know, were drums. So
yeah, I have to say it's going to be a challenge. Because movement is key, right? But yeah. As somebody who wants to make it accessible, because I have movement, you know, issues, that's honestly some of the biggest blocks where I'm like, how do we? So, you know, hey, listeners out there, if you have ideas,
yeah. And honestly, it could just be like tuning into that like music with like a heavy drum and just even like patting your chest along
good,
to the drums. If you can't move your body fully, like just getting some of that kinetic energy going, even in a small way. And then I think creating a work of art during ritual would also be really cool. It could be like writing or something along those lines. But like what came to my mind when you asked about a fire ritual and I thought about this creative work was connecting the art of the movement to literally like making a painting by dancing on a big piece of paper with like paint on your feet or something. Like that was the image that came to mind. I know it's not like crazy practical, but I was like, fire dancing ritual. And you like make art from it as you are doing the kinetic movement. But yeah, those were just like a couple of ideas that came to mind. The minute you said fire ritual, I was like, it's these images.
That's really brilliant. I love all these ideas. Thinking of the cooking and warmth one and the spiciness. I mean, just to ask it, is the hot ones challenge a ritual? Because I still am
it's a fire initiation
to ship on a regular
fire
basis.
Initiation.
Hot sauce magic. It's a thing and should be. Bonfires, movement, all these things are great. I was going to say on the movement front, you know, if you have people stepping back and forth, you don't need to stop that hard to create a great drum beat. As just, again, a really simple kind of like no training required kind of movement. in creative activities like the foot painting, choreography painting. Additionally, I might suggest, I was thinking about solar focused activities. Ooh. So where sunlight is an element of the ritual itself.
Yeah. Mm.
So you could do this using sundials or prisms.
Oh, yeah.
Be careful with refracting and reflecting of light and focusing of light.
Yeah. Yeah. Fire. You will start fire. You will, I mean, you will invoke the fire element.
Literally. Quite. Maybe not in ways you want.
True. But even like solar powered technology elements, like a speaker that runs on sunlight, or even those little nodding figurines. I mean, you're still using the sun to channel into something that's a part of your ritual. But as another creative exercise I thought about, I love the energy involved in spontaneous storytelling. So this is like the idea of you're creating this original story in the moment, purely powered by the creative energy raised in the moment. And it's a really interesting thing when done with a group. It's much easier solo, because you can take your time and you have total freedom. But with a group, collaboratively, it can be an incredibly magical experience. And it's almost like you're passing the fire back and forth to each other as this story builds and you leave with something that didn't exist before. So just a couple other ideas to share. But you know, our experiences aside, I think we're just really excited to see where your journey goes. And it's clearly an important one to you. So I guess with that, all I have to say is flameo, Hopman.
Flameo. This new moon, we return to the pages of our book club. A good reminder to get out and grab a library card or, you know, start building your own magical library. And you are always welcome to join us for book club. We announce our next book soon, so stay tuned. For these last three lunar revolutions, we've been diving deep into the magic of physics by Felix Flicker. This award-winning physicist takes the leap into the quantum via condensed matter physics, and through that, shows us the magic of the atomic world in which we reside. From crystals to quantum entanglement, magnetic fields to superconductors, Felix Flicker uses the ways of a wizard to demonstrate how the micro and the macro are intricately tied. Not at all shy on the science aspects of physics, Flicker does a good job of breaking it down. Now, this book was a bit dense with some heavy physics, so if someone were to ask you, what is this book about, or what was your biggest takeaway, what would be your response?
Well, for me personally, it's a great overview of physics, specifically condensed matter physics, and the ways it magically shows up in our lives. It's less of a look at this magic, it's science book, and more of a look at this science, isn't it magical type book.
Ooh, that's a good...
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, I think that the blurb on the top sums it up the best. An award-winning Oxford physicist draws on classical sci-fi, fantasy fiction, and everyday phenomena to explain and celebrate the extraordinary properties of the world around us. My biggest takeaway is that life is so much more magical and scientifically complex than we may ever know, and we are always discovering new and exciting things about how everything works, and Dr. Flicker does a great job of distilling it and making it interesting.
Yeah, that's a great overview. I would say for me, the big takeaway was, first and foremost, this, through all the physics and science, a much deeper connection to what energy really is. Like, what am I working with on an atomic level, at a subatomic level, and how things connect and why they connect. It's really quite brilliant once everything is put into context that, as you'll see, it's like this, it's this process I'll talk about where it's like at first it's just magic because you don't know how it works, and then it kind of gets a little less magical as you're learning, but then because you've learned so much, it's even more magical knowing how it works. And given that too, that is leading me to providing like deeper thoughts in meditation, just a more like thoughtful appreciation too for choosing specific materials for spell work or energy related techniques like charging or storing energy. Like, all of this just doesn't mean the same thing it did before I read this book, now that I read this book. And I just want to keep learning more. Condensed matter physics really is this like incredibly fascinating and important field, especially as technology continues to advance and things like quantum computers become more of a reality amidst the frontier of technology. So I think those would be my big takeaway highlights.
Yeah, for me, it's this type of science that's truly at the heart of really an atomic practice, right? As a kid, I was deeply fascinated by science, specifically electricity and magnetics, and then came physics in high school and my mind was blown. So when I started to look at my spirituality, I really wanted to align with what I was learning about my universe. And this book does exactly that for me. You know, from why crystals hold their own unique magical, you know, quote unquote, but really scientific properties, to how quantum entanglement allows for all things all at once until a perceived moment in time. You know, it's the micro and the macro, the cosmic and the quantum. I love it so much. Now, we don't want to get too deep into the science, but we do want to hint at what Felix covers in the book so we can tie it back into how it pertains more specifically to witchcraft and atomic practice. So let's just take a minute and we're going to just talk through kind of the things he touches on in the book.
Yeah. Well, up top, the journey of this book is taken in a format that it's kind of in the shape of reflecting one's journey in understanding science, and in many ways, magic. In fact, it's done in that metaphor of, like, you're a fan of magicians, and then you learn how the magic trick is done, and then you, knowing that how it's done, makes it even more magical itself. So it's this journey of discovery felt in three stages. Stage one is magic is amazing. Science is amazing. Because I don't understand how it's possible. And, you know, this is like when you're young and we're just fascinated by the world around us. And so too in learning of science and magic, everything is new and it's so automatic to marvel at the wonders before us. So then stage two is I know how it's possible and it's become a little less amazing maybe. You know, this second stage comes along as learning deepens. We begin to understand how the world around us performs its magic. And like a magician's fan learning how to perform the tricks, there's a slight dimming of the spark here. Cold rationality seems to be replacing the hot excitement. And unfortunately, it's easy to get stuck in this stage. So, you know, cynically, the curtain's been pulled away and it's debunked what you thought was mysterious and magical. But therein comes stage three, which is I've learned even more. And it's become more amazing than initially. So with patience and perhaps a bit of a leap of faith, that rekindled fire illuminates the full truth of what you're looking at in the reality of the performance of the magic and its effectiveness. That's the most magical thing of all. This leap of faith simply asks us to deepen our learning past the second stage. And this three-stage journey frames up a lot of the overall flow of how Felix Flicker tackles all the deep concepts of the book. So it's kind of a handy framework to keep in mind sort of throughout the whole reading.
Yeah, most definitely. It was very helpful.
Yeah, and then from there, Dr. Flicker has this fun set of rules, quote unquote, of wizardry, and by extension, science, that he keeps calling back to throughout the book. And I think they provide a similar frame to kind of how we approach witchcraft, and for me, really grounds my practice in science. And these rules are that one, a wizard studies the world. Two, a wizard understands that they are a part of the world that they are studying. A wizard's understanding leads them to see hidden patterns and connections that others do not. We talk about this all the time on our podcast. Four, a wizard's knowledge is of practical, hands-on kinds. Once again, something we also talk on about. And finally, a wizard can cause changes to the world, but they make such changes sympathetically, which kind of comes back to that rule number two. But then he also adds this hidden implied rule of rebellion, which states that a wizard, or witch, understands that rules are made to be broken.
This tale of wizardry and condensed matter physics begins with the realm of emergence, or as Flicker describes, how interactions between atoms on the smallest scales of length and time lead to large-scale effects in our middle realm. The macro and the micro, the cosmic and the quantum, and the emergence from one to the other. Flicker asks, what makes a pile of sand? Two grains? Three? Five? A billion? Flicker explains how the matter of our world is the sum of its parts, how the micro defines the macro, but on the atomic scale. Flicker details how the states of matter pair up nicely with Epictetus's classical elements. Earth is solid, water is liquid, air is gas, and fire is plasma. He then dives into each element as a state of matter and explores their complexities from an atomic level. Most importantly, the author uses this time to introduce us to the magic of magnetics. He describes the three common types of magnetics, diving deep into how natural magnetics, or ferromagnets, are created via phase transitions, or when matter goes through a state change, like the cooling of iron. He also shares the magic of scale invariance, where the scale is replicated through the entire structure of matter, from the micro to the macro, like how cloud particles look like, well, clouds, no matter what size they are. Felix uses practical examples like hand warmers and tea brewing throughout to engage us with the magic of the quantum.
Then we move on to the magic of crystals, which is a wildly fascinating chapter. Here, Dr. Flicker's definition of a crystal goes beyond just items like amethyst. It includes metals, to ice, up to silicon microchips, which are crystals that help power items like our smartphones. Now, this chapter gets really dense, so I'll do my best to keep it kind of top level and brief. He starts off by exploring the quote-unquote magics that crystals can conduct, like magnetism, this power to attract or repel. There's also tribal luminescence, which is the phenomena of crystals glowing and banged together. And yes, this is a very real thing that you can test by blending sugar crystals in the dark. Another magic is bifringence, which is a crystal's, like calcite, ability to create a double image when looked through. Quartz, specifically, when squeezed, it exhibits a piezoelectricity, which is an electrical potential in the form of a voltage. It is that stored energy. We find piezoelectricity in the sparking elements of lighters, so it's cool to think that the quartz on your altar holds the power to create flame you light with your candle with. For most of these subjects, Dr. Flicker breaks each of them down, starting with the core concept behind these magics and building up from there. It's part of why the book is so dense, but also adds so much context to our magical world.
Speaking of the magical world, the occult and science have long been intertwined, albeit in a complicated relationship. Flicker shares that before there was thermodynamics, there was alchemy, and while not maybe a scientific field now, the advancements made then via chemistry in that time still echo today. So thermodynamics ushered in the era of modern science, and it has three laws, which Flicker shares by way of the beat poet Allen Ginsberg. The zeroth law, you're playing a game. The first law, you can't win. The second law, you can't even break even. The third law, you can't stop playing. Now, this has a pretty nihilistic attitude, and I'm not going to lie. The laws of thermodynamics essentially state that once something has reached thermal equilibrium, its energy will continue to change state, which means you can't win, can't break even, and due to the complexities of the cycle, you can't stop playing. You essentially burn out. Flicker gets into the specifics here in a really delightful way, and it's a great read for understanding how energy works.
Next, we arrive at quantum physics in the chapter Beyond the Fields We Know. As portrayed in many a science fiction setting, the quantum realm is indeed a microscopic world of possibilities and probabilities. On the quantum level, particles have a probability of being somewhere until measured, at which point they are found, but now have a probability of being somewhere else. The word quantum means discrete or separate, as in separate and measurable. So in a subatomic world where anything can be in two places at once, which are called superpositions, this means the magic is what happens before measurement occurs.
Mind blown.
It's this world of probabilities and measurements that makes quantum mechanics an incredibly powerful model for understanding the universe, and has been tested to more precise levels than literally anything else by far in any field of science. It's thanks to quantum mechanics that we can know the structure of stars, that we can know how to build lasers, and how the lasers we built, that we can use them now for things like fiber optic internet communication, and how medical imaging devices work.
Flicker uses some great storytelling techniques to explain physics, and perhaps my favorite is the theory of the knot makers. The knot makers document their world, past, present, and future. And through the tying of very specific knots, whose readings are indecipherable to the common bystander, they hold deep impact as to two stories woven into one. Now, Flicker uses this analogy to introduce how the electric charge ions, the presence of magnetism, creates the stage for quasi-particles throughout the discovery of spin ice. Or rather, crystal atoms with magnetic monopoles offer us new potent possibilities. It comes down to, what if magnetism worked like electronics? Over the next few chapters, Flicker uses this analogy to talk about spells of division and protection. In Division, he explains how magnetic monopoles of spin ice offers us the ability to divest from electric flows of modern computing, and in Protection, how we might embrace the power of that quantum. Yet, this doesn't come without some complication, and a bit of a hidden superpower.
We continue in this quantum world, and in how things are tied together, with the subject of quantum entanglement. You may have heard of this. This is a big topic, but a brief example here is via the classic example of Schrödinger's box. We understand that on a quantum level, all possibilities exist all at once, So in a box, let's say that there could be a cat. There could not be a cat, too. So long as the box remains closed, this cat could exist in any form. The minute I open the box, the cat's existence and nature is confirmed because it is measured. Now let's say we have two boxes. Quantum entanglement says that whatever is in one box will also determine what's in the other box. And even more magical, they will both be determined at the time I open one of the boxes. Until then, they both exist in all possible states, not even matching states. But then the minute the lid is opened, because their fates are tied via entanglement, the states of both cats are decided. You could say it's quantum magic. This chapter also explores how quantum computing is a representation of that ultimate real-world application of this magic of entanglement. And look, I'm going to be honest here. This question of how entanglement works was really racking my brain in both reading this and preparing to talk about this for this episode. But as I dug deeper, I actually learned something really amazing through this book and through additional more materials as I just kept digging. This question of why or how entanglement works is still one of the most perplexing concepts of quantum mechanics.
Oh yeah, that's what's so great about it, is like nobody understands why it works, it just does.
I felt so much better.
Yeah, like, no, it's okay, you don't understand this, like nobody understands. No one gets...
If you understood it, we'd be winning Nobel Prizes left and right.
You would win the prize.
We would win.
We truly don't know why it exists. No one does, but we know it exists. Yeah. And we can understand how it occurs, and we can recreate that. Einstein himself spent a good amount of his time trying to disprove entanglement. And it's actually kind of funny. They talk about, there's some lectures from him on the subject, and they're kind of incoherent and rambly. And
he didn't really get anywhere with it.
And a test was developed decades later that kind of proved it. And so at the end of the day, what we do know is that entanglement is a part of the many ways that the natural world around us is indeed something we can interact with without it being full of quantum weirdness. AKA, this is why you can put things in your cauldron without them potentially falling right through onto the floor below, because the probability was such. That doesn't happen because of entanglement.
Yeah, I always love it. It's not because everything is working well. It's because things are actually maybe not working so well that everything actually works.
Yeah.
And honestly, it all blows my mind. And Dr. Flicker ends the book with a look into the future and the potential of superconductors, or what he calls the Philosopher's Stone. A superconductor is a tool that conveys electrical current without a loss of energy. Our current systems, for example, power lines, convey electricity with a loss of energy, either via heat or sound. Ever hear the hum of power lines? That is a loss of energy. Mm-hmm. This magical tool would prevent that loss. But here's the catch. They have only ever been found at very cold temperatures. Like extremely cold. Like -387 degrees Fahrenheit cold.
Colder than mercury.
Yes. Which, when certain metals are cooled to this extreme temperature, they transmute into superconductors. Hence the Philosopher's Stone metaphor. They are able to defy the second law of thermodynamics, which is energy tends toward entropy, or loss, from the way their subatomic particles behave after this transmutation. We do currently use this to power certain things in our world, like MRIs and maglev trains, but it takes a lot of energy to keep things cold enough to work. The magic of the future is finding a superconductor, creating this little dance of subatomic particles in a way that exists in a room temperature environment.
Phew. Well, now that was a lot of science, even for us. And truly just a quick overview of some of the things that were in that book. So I definitely recommend reading it. But what does this actually mean for how we might apply this information to our own practice? So how are you two taking this in?
Yeah, number one, I found that those wizard's rules that I talked about at the top apply heavily to witchcraft, especially how I think we tend to approach it. As witches, we exist in and study the world. We are looking for those webs of connection. We seek to change things in reality, but stay grounded in the hands-on. And of course, rules are made to be broken is just a good rule of thumb. I also love the way that Dr. Flicker presents the metaphor about superconductors via dancing in a fairy ring. It's a really cool part of the chapter. Each particle pairs with another, dancing in the other direction, and this endless dance is what conducts the energy. It calls back to how in witchcraft we use movement and dance, specifically in a spiral or circle, to raise up and generate energy, either by ourselves interacting with the energy around us or by building it between each other. Overall, this book just added a deeper layer of substance to my practice by tying it into the magic of the science all around us.
I couldn't agree more. In my own practice, I see application in that three-stage journey. You know, stage one perfectly sums up my witchy beginnings. Mm-hmm. You know, with every new word, every new tool, everything I put on my altar, everything was magical and so amazing, and I was equally excited and daunted at the thresholds I was crossing. As I mentioned before, I was terrified of tarot cards. Then in stage two, you've learned more and you arrive at this like tricky intersection, especially in our heavy science-based practice, our atomic witchcraft.
We will hit that moment.
Mm-hmm. You get this intersection of science and belief, and you know, this can be a moment that dims the magic a bit, you know, from either side, if depending on where your discomfort may lie. Maybe you're less comfortable with the science part, or you're less comfortable with the belief part. But, you know, that extra bit of patience, extra bit of focus, extra bit of learning and trial and error, that is what provides our embers with that extra waft of air they need to spark bright into stage three, reaching that stage where the magic is indeed where science and belief intermingle, and it's the effectiveness of witchy workings. That's what makes evident just how magical the world around us really is. And the magical nature of the world around us is where I connect big time with the quantum physics elements here. The big word here being possibility. Mm. Quantum behaviors remind me what magic is all about. Channeling intent coupled with magical and mundane actions enriches the possibilities of the outcomes we long for. Entanglement deepens the thought here in appreciating how the universe is intrinsically tied together. It fits really well with this idea of the atomic web we're always working in. As above, at the cosmic scale, so below, down at the subatomic level. Yeah. In short, there's more magic around us and within us than we'll ever know. And this book and the science it covers helps me tap into that magic in a whole new way. I'm so glad we read it.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm so excited that you both kind of had that same journey. You know, for me, this book is at the heart of the atomic practice, right? It delves into the micro so that we can see the magic of the macro, like you were saying. And for me, that's really what it's all about. I definitely echo the three-stage journey as a great comparison for witchcraft journey and even more practical elements. You know, for instance, crystal magic has always been a bit tough for me because, you know, who decides what a crystal means? Yet, if I turn to its atomic qualities, like quartz crystals being physioelectric, is that how you said it?
Yeah.
Incorporating a crystal with these properties into my firework sounds very witchy to me. So just like the power of lodestones and why we feel them so deeply, their magnetic properties are talking to our magnetic properties. You know, quantum entanglement offers us the concept of infinite potential up until the specific moment in time when things become as they are. You know, this is all so magical to me. And that potential is huge where the work can happen and we can have that, you know, future impact. In closing, you know, what's your verdict? Are we keeping it on the bookshelves?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was a really fascinating book. However, I will say that unless you come into this book with a bit of baseline science knowledge or even just an interest in very scientific subjects, it may be more of a slog to read for you. I definitely recommend it if you want to dig into the atomic side of atomic witchcraft and are all right going back and rereading things if you don't understand them the first round. So if you got that science urge, for sure keep it on the bookshelf. I loved it.
Yeah, I'm absolutely keeping it around too. I'm definitely going to keep rereading it. It's a truly unique book. This inner mix of information, metaphor, humor. He's really funny.
Yeah, he's really funny.
There's all these funny little asides and side references and anecdotes, and they're just all great. And it's all in this magically inclined style with lots of witchy connection that make it really stand out a lot. It is a challenge at times. The information can be really abstract, and given a lot that's being covered is literally theoretical or at an imperceivably small or galactic scale. But there are rich rewards in allowing yourself to take this one in slowly.
Yeah, I'm going to echo what both of you said with an emphasis on Alyssa's comment about being a science-minded human. If you find that you do not digest science well in written format, I might skip it. Mm-hmm. However, if you do, if you were at all interested in an atomic practice, I would definitely recommend.
Resistance Radio, warrior witch tuning in to bring you ways mundane and magical to fight fascism, kick capitalism, protest patriarchy, and converge with community. All while we decolonize, deprogram, and fight for anti-racism, equal rights, and trans lives. And of course, knowing when to rest and regroup, for that in itself is an act of rebellion. This week, staying on theme, we are tending the fires of resilience, because let's face it, this fight isn't going away anytime soon.
Nope.
Which means we not only need to stoke our internal fire, but keep it burning, even when things get wet and rainy emotionally. It's a rough world out there, and as more and more of the effects start to hit closer and closer to home, it's going to be harder and harder to find time and space to breathe life into fires of resistance, which is where resilience and perseverance come in. Resilience lets us adapt in the wake of adversity and change. It's what tells us where to go next. Perseverance is what gets us there. It's the continued effort to do or achieve something despite difficulties, failures, or opposition. So between the rallies, protests, and big days of action, how do we keep those fires alive? Well, it can start with continued dedication to learning and growth, and be as simple as opening a book, watching some videos, or joining a workshop. While it may seem like this isn't the time for learning, I would argue that it's the best time for learning. You get to put it in action right away, and nothing helps us learn better than getting hands-on. Workshops are great for this, and many groups, such as Indivisible, are hosting virtual workshops on how to create active non-compliance, something we will touch on in an upcoming episode. Workshops offer valuable practice and community and come in a variety of shapes and sizes, from emergency preparedness to nonviolent communication and de-escalation techniques. These skills become our weapons. Now, for books to revisit or crack open to get going, we've mentioned lots of titles in the past, and I'd like to add two to your list that are specifically the crossover of witchcraft and activism. Tarot for the Hard Work by Maria Minnis, and this in seconding a book Alyssa read last book club, Revolutionary Witchcraft by Sarah Lyons. Tarot for the Hard Work is a workbook style offering with lots of great recommendations that expand beyond the teaching of the book itself. Commit and engage. It's a unique perspective on the work that really asks that we step up to the plate and deliver. So, when was the last time you checked in on your anti-racism or ally journey, or learned more about your community history or native flora and fauna? Whatever you're passionate about saving, now is the time to step in and learn all you can about it. Knowledge is power, and in a culture that continually talks negatively about education, it is not just power, it is a weapon. Consider this a time for sharpening your blade.
Just me in the background, pumping my fist like, yeah!
And as knowledge is power, and any well-tended fire needs fuel, so if your flame is getting burnt out, investing time in building out your resistance library is a doubly worthwhile choice. On the one hand, this is a time when those in power are desperate to purge away any stories or information that contradict their worldview or agenda. So to build up bastions of uncensored information is to thwart this suppression and to tap into the role of keeper of knowledge, wisdom, and story. Providing access to your library to those who need it ensures these stories and experiences live on in spite of the efforts to control information flows. And then on the other hand, this library is for you too. Don't forget to read your things that you are collecting. Fueling the fire here means reminding yourself of the diversity of experiences in the world and the power of truth and justice. And cracking into the right resource can often get you moving again when you're starting to feel used up or stuck in one particular frame of mind. You already heard some great examples of books you could crack into from Ash just now. But besides getting inspired and informed by your resistance library, let's talk about staying informed, but not overwhelmed. We talked last time about weeding through the noise, how to control the fire hose of news. So with so much going on, it's harder than ever. And even when you've got your notifications customized and your CARS method in the mix, you might still want something to do when you're away from the headlines. So first and foremost, rest. My fellow witches, in rest we find rejuvenation and the refresh we need. Just like having headline consumption on a schedule is a good call, putting your rest on a schedule too is a good companion to that. But in addition to rest, a resistance library is a great tool to have at your disposal here as well. Inspiring stories and valuable resources keep you going. Sometimes the best way to counteract frustration or anger is seeing it in the context of more points of view, global perspective, or historical patterns. which leads me to my third recommendation here, which is to imagine a better future. You know, the classic aphorism, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, is certainly an important thought these days. But what's the call for those who do remember and who do refuse to forget? What do? We've got to make a point to imagine a better future. This might look like holding a protest sign that doesn't just denounce the issue or person, but provides the better option. It might involve supporting new and rising leaders or challenging the current ones in ways we've taken for granted, which as Bridge Builder invites us to not just call out injustice, but recognize and weave together the separate threads before us to create something new and better. A bridge to tomorrow, if you will. It's our magical superpower to see and empower the atomic web within, around, and beyond ourselves. Sorry if I'm getting a little extra philosophical here, but if there was ever a time and a moment to think past tomorrow, this is it. Tying this again to tending the fire, this Protopian-style thinking is exciting and galvanizing and might just be the thread you need to pull you forward and keep your hearth lit with the fire you need.
In order to imagine a better future, we need that spark of inspiration. So another way that you can keep this fire going is to tune into things that inspire you. This could be attending a talk on something you find really interesting, going on a hike with an amazing view, following content creators who do things that you find really cool. Shout out to Rachel Maxey and Bernadette Banner, my personal inspiration sources. It's hard to want to do things when you're feeling uninspired. So igniting that in yourself is a great tool in getting it done. Even if what's inspiring you doesn't have anything to do with the action you are taking, carve out those moments to seek this excitement. And while we're on the subject of inspiration, let's talk about art. If there is anything that fascism and authoritarianism hates, it's art. It's this act of self-expression. Go out and engage with art in your community. Support a local open gallery night. Go see a community theater production. Attend your friend's slam poetry night. Listen to that concert in the park. Jay and I went to a theater in the park festival in Seattle recently, and just being in community, laughing, enjoying a couple of productions was so rejuvenating and inspiring. And don't just engage with art, create art. You don't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be amazing. Just create. Break out those watercolors, dust off that sheet music, get friends together and do a play reading, host a wine and pottery night, heck, write a limerick. Keep that fire burning through the energy that comes with creativity. And speaking of gathering with others, find ways to actively engage in your community. Now, we talked a lot about this in our Resistance Radio about neighboring, but it is a really important aspect to resisting. This movement can't just be all about big protests, but in the in-between times, we keep to ourselves, and we don't keep that fire going within our community. Division is how fire goes out, like how spreading out logs in a campfire makes it extinguish faster. Our resilience lies in each other. So whether your community looks like immediate neighbors, your town, city, your spiritual community, your groups of friends and family, the people you play Dungeons and Dragons with, it's time to lean in. Go to that block party. Help host a food drive for your local food bank. Pick up trash in your park and talk to the people that you meet. Offer help to your neighbors. Vote in small elections. Attend those talks by your local representatives. There are so many options. Gather your people. Gather your community. Be a member of the village. This is how we build resilience within ourselves and within the world around us. And on that note about community, I encourage you to donate to groups and organizations you support if you have the resources to do so. At the time of this recording, media publications like PBS and NPR are having their funding cut. There are LGBTQIA2S+ help hotlines that need extra support with the slashing of the aspect out of the 988 hotline. Arts organizations are finding their federal funds are dwindling. Find what you are about, how much you can afford to donate, and vote with your wallet. You can also engage in mutual aid funds if you want to keep your money within your community. Not sure if an organization is a legitimate one? Use websites like Charity Navigator to make sure their values align with yours. And of course, as witches, we can engage with our practices in ways that keep us feeling resilient.
Maybe you build a daily ritual, something you do to kick off the day that grounds you and keeps that fire smoldering in your core, keeping it ready to be sparked again to a blaze when the time is ready. Maybe you include deity work in your practice, and so choose to lean into that aspect by engaging with and paying devotion to ones that empower you, i.e. you call upon Athena to embody that warrior spirit. And then, of course, there is the practice of lending your energy to the cause. This could look like spell work to help inspire others to action, or perhaps some Widdershins work to bind terrible people in power to the consequences of their actions. And I'll admit, I have engaged with the latter. Find ways to make witchcraft work for you in tending that flame.
Today's episode includes lots of ways to ignite and keep those fires of resilience and perseverance going. Consider it a time of sharpening your weapons. As we build our knowledge through reading and workshops, acquiring our resistance library, gathering in and donating to our communities, hugging our loved ones, tuning into inspirational feeds so that you can stay informed but not overwhelmed, and most importantly, imagining in a better future, and maybe making a little art and doing some witchy shit along the way. Then, when you need a little extra boost, build yourself a fire playlist to ignite and tend the flames of resistance. That wraps up our New Moon Brew episode. We'll be back again just before the full moon for our next Full Moon Brew, featuring the conclusion of my journey with fire magics. We'll also bring you more of the basics via our Witchcraft 101 segment.
In the meantime, you're always welcome to spend time in community with us in our monthly Sunday Havens and in our Discord server.
And join us on Patreon for the newsletter and behind-the-scenes podcast fun, and on social media where we're doing our best to shine light on our favorite creators, educators, and activists.
And until next time,
keep your world witchy.